Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Fitz Nation. I try to get these episodes out in audio form on Wednesday mornings, but it doesn't always happen that way. So I sit here on Wednesday night near 10 o'clock on the West Coast, and I'm getting this episode together with the one and only Cub Swanson, who's now a UFC Hall of Famer, and you could almost call him an MMA pioneer. Right. I mean, he's not a pioneer. He's a modern era fighter, but he's been doing it so long, I think since 2006, that he has really spanned a lot of different eras in the development of mixed martial arts as we know it today and the UFC as we know it today. He fought in the WEC before he fought in the UFC. And what a life he had before that, the upbringing. His father died when he was just a baby. And we get into all that and how he went down the wrong path and what ultimately got him to straighten out. It's quite a story, and it gets a little emotional at several different points, both for, you know, powerful memories that he had when he was growing up and with his mother, and also heartwarming, powerful emotions of when he was inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame in 2022. The full episode is available, as always, on UFC Fight Pass. Just search Fitz Nation or look under Podcast Central and you can watch our conversation. You can also listen to the full conversation on the Fight Pass platform, but I'm happy to share it on this audio platform as well if this is how you take in your podcast. Hey, I have just a bit of news before we get to the interview too. My YouTube channel, which is where the podcast lived before several months ago, it got hacked and it got terminated. It's a long story. I don't want to get into it. It's one of those things where it's unfortunate when you say this thing that I had, you know, I had several thousand subscribers on my YouTube channel. It's where all the old episodes of the podcast lived and tons of different video clips and content and stuff. And it was all just wiped away. But at the same time, it allowed me to hit the reset button. I kind of stepped away from YouTube over the past, you know, basically 6-8 weeks or so. And I didn't know if I was going to launch another channel, but I was going to think about it and just kind of slow down life a little bit, deal with my newborn son and my growing family and kind of sink into our routine. And sure enough, I've thought of a very unique and interesting ways that I can make some content, but it's not going to be related to this podcast. I just dropped an interview with Laura Sanko. It's like 4 minutes. And that's really what it's going to be, because it's a lot easier to track down DC or Bisping or some of these major fight figures that I am often in contact with, and I'm kind of inside the ropes, to use a golf term, in terms of at weigh-ins and backstage and all these things. And for me, it's pretty easy to flip on a camera and do an interview with somebody for 3 to 5 minutes. It's a lot harder to sit down and schedule time with them for an hour and 15 minutes like I did with Cub Swanson. So the podcast is still very valuable. I still love the long-form interviews. But on my YouTube channel, there's a link in the show notes here wherever you're listening. That's going to be short-form content with some big names, behind-the-scenes stuff, and very unique, different ways to look at the fight game from my perspective as a UFC announcer. But I want to get to this episode with the now Hall of Famer, Cub Swanson. What a conversation we had, and I hope you enjoy it here on Fitz Nation.
Fitz Nation, let's go.
I always had to be mega in the zone, ready to go out there on my shield.
Be in the question and don't look for the answer, because the answer is the end.
Think about who I'm fighting for, fight for something greater.
At the end of the day, you got to believe in yourself.
It's time for the Fitz Nation podcast with your host, Brendan Fitzgerald.
All right, we're recording. Hey, Cub Swanson, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for coming to the show. What is camp like for you with a fight coming up in, what, a month, basically?
Yeah, it's been going good. You know, a little stressful. Never been to 135 before, but
yeah.
Everything's been on track and, yeah, feeling strong. I feel like I'm doing it right. So
what led to the decision for you to go down to bantamweight?
Well, I have a couple training partners that have been doing 35 for a long time. And I help them make weight, and then in between fights, they're heavier than me. So, as I've gotten a little bit older, I haven't been able to like hold on as much mass. And so I just felt like, after seeing them make the weight, And then I went to the PI and I actually did like a side-by-side comparison with one of my teammates. And they were like, Cub, I think your weight cut to 35 is easier than his.
Wow.
And I've helped him do it. So that was like kind of the deciding factor. But the reason why I even thought about it was I just felt like I needed things to be a little tougher. I felt like making 45 and the training camps were a little too easy. And I feel like I do my best work when I suffer a little bit. So I kind of wanted to put myself in that fire and, you know, hope for the best to come out.
Yeah. Is that, can you speak to that a little bit more? Like being more on point when things are tougher to get there. That's like a big picture concept. I don't think you're alone in that.
Yeah. Well, I just know that the stress of everything, you know, you kind of, you know, turning the heat up and for whatever reason, it allows like clarity and, you know, it allows more me time to just focus on me and the things that I got to get done, the things that I want to do right after the fight, things I want to do with my family. It was kind of crazy. I correlate fighting with a lot of different other jobs. You know, I like to look, so one of them being like actors, method actors, I feel like have the same kind of mental game as we do. And I was listening to Matthew McConaughey talk about when he did the Dallas Buyers Club and how he dropped to 130 some pounds. And he was saying that he never felt more mentally clear than when he was dieting. He said he hated it and he suffered, but he never felt clear minded. And, you know, you hear people talk about it now with like intermittent fasting. And like I said, I think there's something about that. When you suffer and you hunt and you starve for something, you could really make something great. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. And like, it also very clearly tests how much you want it, because if you don't, then you just stop. You just won't, you won't suffer for it. You got to figure out what you're going to suffer for.
Yeah. And really, like I said, I felt like 45, some of the camps were just a little too easy. And I got there, I've done it so many times. And it got to the point where it's like, you're questioning, like, did I do enough?
Yeah.
You know? And, it was nice because my kids, I got to spend a lot of time with them and help out. And, for this one, you know, I had to have a talk with my wife and say, hey, you're going to have to do a majority of the work. And she was like, yeah, no problem. You know, you focus on you and I'll take care of this. And we're a team like that. So,
yeah,
I have big ups to her and the kids kind of, you know, putting up with me.
So did you go away? Are you away right now?
No, I'm home, but, they're going to like preschool and then my daughter started kindergarten. So,
yeah,
I just kind of go upstairs and separate myself when I need to, when I feel like I'm short, when I'm a little edgy.
Yeah. You know when to get away.
Yeah. And then I'm training a lot during the day when they're here,
right,
in the mornings or at night. So I'm seeing them every day, but just for a small window. And I think it's better, while I'm a little low on energy.
It's also, and we're going to move on to different things, cause I pride the show on not being about weight cuts and fight camps, but, you're like the perfect example. It's like you and Frankie Edgar, like very similar in that you have spanned the different eras of MMA to the point where like you're pro in 06, 07, 08, like you probably could have fought even big at lightweight. Frank was a friggin' lightweight champion. Yeah. And it's just like the way that the sport has gone, the amount of like science that has gone into like weight cutting and everything about it. It's just like, well, yeah, this is, you're a current bantamweight. You're a former bigger class because people just kind of walk in there and fight, you know?
Yeah. Guys are getting bigger. I thought the opposite. I thought that people would start getting a little, you know, a little smaller but that's not the case. Guys just keep getting bigger and I've noticed it. And all like my friends and family, they notice it. They're like, man, that last guy was huge. And I'm like, yeah,
right.
It is.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah. To me, I always think people think about like weight cutting. They're like, oh, how could you do that to your body? And it's like, look, I'd rather, let's say I was damaging my kidney or something like a small amount. I'll take that over having, you know, somebody that has 10, 15 pounds on me, you know, punching me in the head, you know, for long term.
Right.
So I just think it's the smarter way.
Yeah, there you go. I got you. I thought you were going to go to, because there's also the conversation, fighters, man, with that weight cut, what does that do for their health? But it's just like, but you're in insane shape. So yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like most of America can't boast abs, right? But almost all fighters that are not at the heavyweight division can do that. So let's go back, Cub. Like you've told the story, I know. And if people want to like research you, can kind of figure out like where you're from and kind of what you've gone through in your life. But like, just as like an overview, like how would you describe your early years? Because it was a very unique situation that you were in.
Yeah. You know, growing up, the story is that, you know, my mom and dad both had a daughter when they got together. And then my mom and dad got married and they had three kids, me being the third. But so I was the last one of their kids. And when I was born, my father was diagnosed, before I was born, my father was diagnosed with skin cancer. And he ended up passing away when I was 3 months old. So, you know, that really shook up my family. And, you know, my mom had a really tough time. She ended up, you know, struggling with depression and substance abuse. And me and my brothers went to live with my dad's cousin and his wife, and they were like, you know, newly married,
right,
in their early 20s. But yeah, just thinking about that, just like, you know, I didn't have kids till I was 34.
I mean, it's wild because like you go through this story and you can tell it in the rearview mirror, but it's like you were 3 months old, like you have no recollection of that.
Yeah.
Right. So like, how was it for you to, I guess, how, when you looked back on it, like when you figured out it was different, what was that like for you?
I guess it was weird. It never really bothered me because my stepmom and stepdad, I say stepmom, stepdad, cause it just always makes it easy for people.
Yeah.
But when we were growing up, we called them aunt and uncle, and that's how we refer to them, my step family. But I lived with them for 10 years, almost 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
So when I ended up moving in with them when I was 3 years old till 13. And, but yeah, so they were always, my stepmom was always extremely honest and said, we're not your real parents. You know, this is what happened. And since I was very young, so, it was always like, okay, that's just the way it is. And I felt like that was kind of easier for me. I know my brothers, my two older brothers, were all two years apart from each other.
Yeah.
They took it differently because they were different ages. They had different experiences. But for me, that's how I took it. And it just always seemed normal. It didn't really affect me until I think I was a teenager and it started to be a little bit rebellious.
Yeah.
And that was when I moved back in with my mom, and things just got kind of crazy from there.
Yeah. What led to the rebellion from you, do you think? Was it a lot of drugs and alcohol and like, was it all that stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I started, you know, I was raised because my step family was, you know, we went to church all the time. I was homeschooled. I felt like I was very sheltered, me and my brothers. And I felt like my step family felt like they couldn't make a mistake. So they kept a very, tight leash on us. And everyone in my church community that I hung out with, everybody kind of was on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the kids were homeschooled, very, sheltered, I would say.
Yeah.
And so it kind of created this illusion that I was living in like a perfect world almost, which was nice. And I was very guarded from bad stuff. But then when they ended up getting a divorce when I was 13, and I lived with my stepmom for a little bit, and then the opportunity came up to move back in with my mom, and I felt like it was time to try to give my mom that you know, she had been clean and sober for years and just didn't feel like she could you know, do as good of a job as my step family. So when they got divorced, she kind of voiced that she wanted us back. So I went, I'm the one that made the decision to go back and, you know, see what it was like and live with my, I had three little sisters by then and, you know, live with my family, my biological family, and just see what it was like. But during that whole thing, my mom lived in a very rough neighborhood and, you know, I just kind of had to toughen up really quickly. And you know, in that whole situation of me having to toughen up and just getting a new leash on life and realizing things weren't in this bubble that I kind of thought, and that majority of people in my new world, you know, there was drugs and alcohol and gangs and just, it was a completely different style of life. And I realized that to be tough and to survive, I needed to toughen up. And I just kind of was in a rebellious mode, and I went the complete other way.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess that's luck. Us fighters, we're kind of extreme personalities. So.
Uh-huh. And when you look back on it, like, as you're telling this story of, like, toughening up in bad neighborhood, you know, for lack of a better term, you're smiling a lot. why does that bring like a smile to your face when you think back on this rebellious phase when things were a little hectic and you weren't in the nicest situation? Why do you think that is?
I guess it's just the, you know, a little bit of not embarrassment, just, you know, just me being honest and you know, telling the story of where I came from and what developed me, I think is a personal thing. And I'm very happy with everything that I've gone through because it made me who I am. I think it's just, it's just a little bit, you know, opening up it, you know, which I don't mind doing.
Right.
It just, takes you to a place. Yeah.
Yeah. It's nothing to be certainly ashamed of or embarrassed of or anything like that. But when you think back on your past and your upbringing and now that you have a wife and three kids and a good career that to be proud of and all these in more means than you probably had growing up, like, is it something where not you wish it wasn't part of your story, but it's not like what defines you? You know what I'm trying to say? Like, do you try to like shed it? It's just like, yeah, that's a part of me and that's a part of my past, but it's not like where you should start with my story type of thing.
I think it's okay for people to like, you know, that because that is my story. I think the bigger thing at this point is like my kids, you know?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, I don't want them to know all the stories. You
know, right, like, right.
I think that's one of the reasons why I don't live back home. I live in Orange County and not in the Palm Springs area. I just feel like I don't think they need to grow up hearing about, you know, crazy stories about me running the streets, which in the grand scheme of things, it was only a couple years of my life. You know, usually when people report on the kind of the story, that's what they focused on was the trouble, you know, but that was only a 4 or 5 year window of time.
Right.
And a lot went on in that. And it is crazy because in that time frame, I really felt like, okay, this is my life now. This is what it is. And it really took for, you know, being with Kenda and you know, just growing up and traveling and just going, okay, the little pocket of craziness that I lived in for a while, that's not normal and it doesn't have to be normal. And, you know, you don't have to get used to bad news happening all the time or hearing somebody got shot or hearing about someone getting in an accident or someone overdosing. Like those were like normal things to hear. on a regular with me having such a big family and there being a lot of people that, you know, got into trouble in my family and stuff. So just knowing that that stuff doesn't have to be normal and pull myself out of it, pull my kids out of it. And
yeah.
So yeah, I'm proud of where I'm at right now.
What was the change for you that started straightening you out?
I always tell people it was taking responsibility, really, because I remember distinctively I kept getting into trouble, and then like the cops would pick me up, and they really targeted us, like a whole group of us. And they, you know, the police was, they were like a gang, and I was terrified of them because they would see me on site and they would come mess with me, and they roughed me up a couple times. They busted in when I was living with my brothers. When we first moved out, they busted into our house without a warrant a couple times, just kicked our door in, pulled guns on us, told us to shut up, look for some people, and left. Like, it was just craziness. But I had gotten picked up a couple times and they let me go for fighting or whatever nonsense. Yeah. And then one time, I got picked up with another kid, and he had broken into this RV, and we had been drinking and just like doing pretty much nonsense. And because it was an RV, they basically said it was like a breaking and entering to a house because there was a bed in there.
Mm-hmm.
And no one was in there. But yeah, so the kid was on probation when it happened, and he got a lawyer, and his lawyer pretty much blamed it on me and said that I bullied the kid, even though he was the real bad.
He was the perpetrator. Yeah.
And so my mom had no money. She was barely making it. And she was like, I'm going to get you a lawyer. And I remember that moment just being like, no, like you could barely afford food. I'm not going to allow you to get a lawyer and spend that money on a stupid mistake that I made. So I think I was like 16 years old, and I was like, no, I did this. I remember getting so mad at me too, like, quit being so stubborn. And I was like, no, I did this. I'll get myself out. You know, I can do this on my own. She was like so mad about it, and because I didn't get a lawyer and all that, and got blamed, the other kid got out on probation. I got denied probation, got denied house arrest, got denied basically time served in the juvenile hall, and I got sentenced to a year. And so because I had to do a year in juvenile hall, and I did 3 months in the juvenile hall and then mm-hmm. 9 months in a group home. And I felt like at that point, when I started taking responsibility for the things I did, it changed my mindset, because I had a lot of downtime to think about, why am I here? How come none of my friends are here?
Yeah.
You know, like, it was crazy. I had just shaved my head, like bald with like bicked it for the first time. I never liked to do
that.
And when I walked into the juvenile hall, I guess I looked like somebody from a gang that nobody liked, because there's like some big gangs in there. Basically, there's like 130 kids, and I'd say 90% of them were like from three different major gangs. And so I was in the gang that they thought I was from is the one that they all hate. So when I first walked in there, I got hit up like crazy, and they thought I was somebody else. And, you know, there was like a gut check, and just realizing that I'm fending for myself, and that I was trying to mind all my, you know, P's and Q's to get out of there. Cause I'm like, all right, I'm here long enough. I get in any fights, anything bad happens, it adds time. And so, but at the same time, it's a tricky situation, because if you don't stick up for yourself, they will pick on you in terrible ways.
Yeah.
And so, I basically had to use my smarts to, and sometimes my toughness to to get out of situations where people were trying to, you know, punk me, trying to take my spot in line, or, you know, take something from me. And I'd have to say, no, it's not going to happen. And then they'd act like we were going to fight and be like, okay, damn, you can't back down or it's going to get worse. And then think like, damn, all right, I'm going to have to, you know, get into it with this person and possibly add to my time. And then they were just testing me. And it's like, oh, you passed that test. It's like, man.
Yeah.
It was just like a crazy experience. But that time has never left me. I learned a lot in those situations.
Yeah. I mean, it's still like, I would imagine, burned into your brain in terms of like what you had to deal with and go through.
Yeah. 100%.
Small decisions leading to something that's really big to deal with on the back end, you know?
Yeah. And it gave me so much time to think, well, cause there's a lot of downtime and, thinking about evaluating all of the decisions I had been making and going, okay, what I realized from all that time was responsibilities, right? Responsibilities keep you in check. And when I decided that I didn't want any responsibilities, that I could do whatever I wanted and, you know, just enjoy life. And my motto when I decided to rebel was F it, you know, like if I was supposed to go to class and somebody was like, hey, let's ditch and go do this. And I'd be like, all right, F it, let's go. You know, that was just my mentality. And I realized that that's what led me to juvenile hall, you know, was disregarding any kind of responsibility and just saying, go with the flow. And, after that, I learned responsibility. I needed responsibilities to keep me in check and to keep me on the straight and narrow. And, after juvenile hall, I tried to go into the military and they wouldn't take me because I was on probation and all that. And I knew I needed discipline in my life.
So much so that you wanted to go military, right? Yeah. That's wild, right? The swing like that.
And that was like crazy thing was, that was 9 months before 9/11 happened.
Wow.
And so they were like, no, sorry, we don't want you. No. And I was like, what about a different branch? I think I would be good. I think that if I had discipline, I would be really good. And they were like, no one's going to take you. So it really shot it down. And, I'm glad that it worked out that way. And the next thing I stumbled upon, took me a couple of years, was jujitsu. And then once I found jujitsu, cause I had stopped getting into trouble after juvenile hall, but I didn't stop like doing drugs and hanging out with the same people. I just didn't do anything, you know, stupid.
Right. Right.
But, once I found jujitsu, I never touched drugs again. And that was when I was 19 years old.
Wow. What example did you have when you were straightening out, like in juvenile hall and then like getting out, but like you said, you're still kind of drugs, alcohol, and just kind of floating, just not making any silly mistakes. But like, what example did you have and who you wanted to become at that point?
I didn't have any example, honestly.
Were you looking for one? Did you think something was out there and you were just trying to find it? Like, what were you looking for then? And then ultimately it was jujitsu that was what you found.
Yeah. I really wasn't looking. I just was trying to find my purpose and wondering like, man, I really thought that I would be something. I really thought that as a kid. I always had big dreams. Originally always wanted to be a professional soccer player. When I started kind of realizing that's a difficult thing, I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy and be a fighter pilot. And I knew that I could play soccer there. I had an uncle from my stepfamily that worked at the Air Force Academy in Colorado, and I had visited it and loved the place. And I was like, man, I could do that. And when I started in high school, my freshman year, I even was in ROTC because they had convinced me because that was when I first started going back to public school from being homeschooled. So it was quite a culture shock for me, you know, being back in like normal public school and realizing that I didn't know anything about being cool or or right. if I didn't yeah. fit in. And then when I realized that ROTC was something people made fun of and not like something respectable, that kind of put a damper on that.
Right.
And realizing like, man, I really pigeonholed myself in with the nerds. And I was able to see like, man, if I do this, I'm going to get made fun of. And if I go over here with my cousins and my older brother, and they're at a table where nobody talks to them disrespectfully, like they have respect
and yeah. they
have power, I'll go sit over there and no one will talk to me that way, you know?
Yeah.
So it was kind of like a safety mechanism, of just realizing where I needed to be, so I didn't get messed with.
So how did you find jiu-jitsu?
So I had been wanting to try some kind of a new sport because I played soccer, and I even played 1 year of junior college. Somehow, even though I had been on my own, and it was quite difficult. I was 17 years old. I had graduated high school early. I had gotten out of the boys' home, and the crazy story of that is I've told it a couple of times. Is I was behind a whole year, and when I went into juvenile hall, and I was the summer of my senior year. And my whole junior year, I didn't really attend. So yeah. when I was in there for 2.5 months, I did a whole year's worth of work. I used to sneak the books back. I was allowed to take the books, but I couldn't take a pencil because it's contraband, because they think you could stab someone. So I used to break the tip of the pencil and hide it in my shoe, in the Velcro in my shoe. And then I would go on the toilet where there was no cameras, and you roll up toilet paper really tight, and you keep twisting it, and you pull the elastic out of your underwear, and you tie it up, and you can make a pencil. And I did a year's worth of work in 2 months and caught up. So by the time I went to my group home, I got to go to a normal high school and graduated early. That was something I was really proud of.
Wow. That's wild. That's a wild story, Cub. Sneaking in pencils to read on the toilet where there's no cameras so that you could like get your education. And like, so you really took that to heart when you went in, like, this is the change. This is the life change.
Yeah, it was because, you know, I've always been pretty, you know, simple with my decisions. My stepmom always would tell me taught me to really evaluate things and make a good calculated decision. She always said we're an educated guess, and that kind of always stuck with me because I'm pretty logical. And so when I was in juvenile hall and going to school, and I looked, they would give us workbooks, and the teachers didn't really care because they just got harassed all the time. And
yeah. there was like
8 to 10 kids per class, and the kids were like, they weren't the smartest because they really didn't do well in school. And I actually was pretty smart, and I was homeschooled. So I got a lot of attention. And so when I looked at the workbooks and saw how it was kind of easy. And then when I'm looking at the kids, what they're doing, and they're playing like Oregon Trail on like these ancient computers. And like, I was like, man, those games aren't even fun.
Right.
And I was like, should I play these games that I'm like not even enjoying, or just do this work? And so I just decided, all right, these guys are all slacking off, I'm just going to do this work. And then once I started doing it, I got obsessed, and I just wanted to get through it as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And I was able to accomplish that. And then, you know, to be able to do it in my room was kind of scary because, like I said, I didn't want to get more time. I didn't want to get in trouble. It's a very serious offense to do what I did, but I felt like I was doing it for the right and not the wrong reasons. So I mm-hmm. wasn't too concerned about it.
Yeah. So, but back to the jiu-jitsu thing, right? Because we hear this all the time, like martial arts will straighten out somebody's life, gives it purpose. What was that for you in terms of the click of just like no more drugs, no more alcohol, just totally focused on something positive?
I was looking for something, you know, to just keep my mind occupied. And so once I didn't have sports anymore, like me and my brothers were always athletic. Like we would go to the park and play basketball or play, you know, tackle football with random friends or people we just met. Like we just loved playing sports, but we also liked to party. So we just didn't have any like real discipline in that aspect. So once my soccer career was pretty much done, I just partied a lot and we worked, you know, really crappy jobs and barely made ends meet. And, I kept thinking like, man, I need something to occupy my time. And I was thinking about doing like some kind of martial art, maybe Taekwondo. And I thought, man, I'm pretty athletic. I was like, the reality of martial arts at the time I knew was like, not very great, not reality. I was like, I know that traditional martial arts is a lot of fluff. I was like, at the highest level, there's going to be some competition, but I'm pretty sure I could walk into a studio and beat up everybody without having to train, except for maybe the black belts. Mm-hmm. Like that's what I thought in my mind. Because the reality is most of the people that were doing martial arts were nerds, you know, and
unathletic. That's how it is a lot. That's how it is. Yeah.
Because they're just paying to get their belt. So then one day my buddy was like, hey, we're all gonna go to this Brazilian jiu-jitsu class. And I was like, what's that? And he's like, oh, it's a martial art. You haven't seen it? And I was like, no, I never heard of it. So I was pretty excited because I had been on my mind and it was a martial art. So I had it in my mind, and on that day we were gonna go. And then when the day came, it was supposed to be like 10 of us, and everyone had already been drinking and smoking, and they're like, ah, I'm not going to make it. And I was like, man, I was really looking forward to this. I'm still going to go. And me and my brother, Aaron, who's the closest one to me.
Yeah.
Me and him went together, and we got our asses beat. You know, it was like,
thought you were tough guys from the street that were going to roll through everybody. And
cause it was something I had never seen before.
Yeah.
I was
like, totally fighting different
on the ground. Like I thought we were going to be like doing like striking.
Yeah.
And, it blew my mind. And I got beat up by a blue belt, like handled by a blue belt. And my brother got beat up by a white belt. And we both were like, man, and he was like, this is stupid. I'm not coming back. And I was like, really? I was like, I enjoyed it because I'm like baffled at how he beat me up. Like it baffled me. I couldn't figure it out because I'd never seen it before. I'd never heard of it. So I was like, I'm going to get good at this. And so I just went back to the next class, and then I went back again and I told my instructor, I was like, I'm going to be the best student you ever had. And he just kind of laughed. He didn't even remember my name yet. And from then on, I never, like I said, I stopped drinking. I stopped doing drugs. And I just went to every class that I could go. And then I eventually started like running and doing things outside of the gym because they weren't open enough. He only had four classes a week. And so then I started entering myself in jiu-jitsu tournaments because everyone was telling me, oh, you haven't been doing it long enough, you shouldn't do it. And and I had no money, so I would just spend money that I should have been spending on food and other stuff, and I would go enter myself in tournaments in LA and Orange County and San Diego areas, and I would just go out there with like one of my roommates or one of my brothers and with no coach, and I won almost everyone I entered. And so people started going, man, you're actually pretty good at this.
Yeah.
And then, the guys at my gym started hosting like little UFC parties, and that was my first introduction to the UFC.
Wow.
And then we went to a local MMA fight, and after seeing the UFC, I thought, you know, that's crazy. Like, that's like, so, you know, it's looking way too far up. And then after that, I went to a local show and you see some trash fights. And I was like, man, there's some people here that I for sure could beat up. And then I started thinking, man, wouldn't that be crazy to actually schedule a fight, train for it, and then you have to fight that person? I was like, man, that sounds terrifying. I think I want to try that to see like what I'm made of.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to do that. And then I told everyone at my gym and they were like, no, no, you shouldn't do that, because they were like very old school, because we were in Palm Springs, kind of separated from the big groups of jiu-jitsu.
Right. The LA. And
so, yeah. And so we were kind of like, my coach was very old school. And so they was like, you're supposed to be a black belt if you're going to fight, you know? And I was a white belt and I was like, nah, I think I should do it. I think I should do it. And they kept telling me no, that they didn't think it was a great idea. And then I ended up I went to go train with my instructor in Orange County, and one of his other high belts was my manager, who I met, and he's like, I can get you a fight. And that's how he became my manager.
Wow. That was Kami?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you met him that early.
Mm-hmm.
It was wild, you know, what kind of connection that was, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if I was still 19 or 20, mm-hmm. but yeah, we met, and then, he got me a fight in Tijuana. I lost in 30 seconds. And then he got me another fight, and then I went on an 11 fight win streak. But in that time, in those first few years, he would hate that he couldn't get a hold of me, because I lived with my brothers and another roommate, and I was hardly ever home, because I had to drive far to work and then train. And so he ended up buying me a cell phone, and so that he could get a hold of me, and he paid my cell phone bill for like, I think, into my 30s. And I was like, hey man, I was in the UFC for years. I was like, you know, I think I should be paying for my own cell phone. And he was like, nah, don't worry about it. And I was like, nah, it just feels weird. Like I'm like 30, I was like 33 or something. And I was like, do you even paying for my cell phone bill for like, you know, over a decade?
And I mean, you had already fought on like pay-per-view cards in the UFC.
Yeah, yeah.
That's wild. Yeah,
that's just like,
it was a business expense.
Yeah, it was part of the relationship we had.
Yeah,
it was like no big deal, you know.
Right. Wow. What did you think it would be like to be how would you describe the early years of your MMA career? What was it like to be a prize fighter? Because it wasn't really a big thing yet. Like, you were before the Fox deal. Like, you were way back. You were WEC.
Yeah. Well, the cool thing was is that I got into the sport. And when I got into it, I just was like, how is this not the biggest sport in the world? I didn't understand it. And then what really sucked for me, was when I first started it, I was in juvenile hall like a couple years before. And then I started doing this sport. And so like when I would come around my family, for like big family gatherings, my dad's side of the family, we'd catch up on like Thanksgiving and stuff. And they're like, what's this now? You're doing cage fighting? And it was like, I remember distinctively in those days, in the early days when I was still on the lower circuit, people thought of it as the same as like me being in juvenile hall, you know, like it wasn't a respectable sport. It was like, what are you doing? That's terrible. Like, and you want to do this for a living? like it was not something to be proud of or brag about. I remember my manager Kami was like, if you go to court and you have a ticket, you know, like don't tell your boss, don't tell the judge, don't tell anyone you do this. Like, they're just going to make it worse for you. You know, it had like a, you know, it was still frowned upon. So
yeah,
early on it was not something you bragged about, you know, like my friends in the streets thought it was cool, but my like respectable people, they didn't think it was a cool sport. So when I first got into it, that was the stigma, right? But then as soon as I found out, I think I had just turned pro, and I had, because there was no amateur fights back
then. Yeah, exactly. No, it was like, pro. It was so very Wild West.
I had just fought, and then I found out that Dana had been pushing and pushing and then to get the sport bigger and accepted. And then I found out about the Ultimate Fighter Show, and I was like, man, when people see this on TV, they're going to realize that they've been missing out on the sport and that it's the purest sport there is. And you could put whatever spin on it you want, but the reality is this is the purest sport. There's no team, there's no ball, it's one-on-one. It's the closest thing to a real fight. And the new rule set and everything that Dana was doing, like, I was like, man, the way it evolved from no rules, it's going to be huge. And I knew that once it was on, the Ultimate Fighter was on TV and people got to see it, that it would just take off, and I'm in it at the right time. And I thought, man, if I keep doing it, I'm at the perfect time. By the time I peak in my career, I could actually make a living out of this. And that was kind of the motivation to keep
going. Yeah. Wow. So you saw it kind of coming down the pipe. You've seen the whole gamut, basically. I mean, and it's going to keep growing because we're still growing. And I would say, too, we're still very niche. And for some people, it still is not a respectable thing to do.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you just deal with that a lot less these days.
Yeah, but you know what's funny is, like, it's not something I talk about, like, you know, because, you know, most people don't really care about this kind of stuff. But, like, every conversation I have with people since the day I started training, it's been almost 20 years. I love meeting people that are like, it's usually, you know, older women that are like, oh, you do that? It's like, yeah, well, it's, you know, and you just explain to them why it's such a great sport and the beauty of it and the respect and honor. And yeah, that there's grudges here and there, but for the most part, it's a respectable thing, and it's changed me in this way, and this is who I am. And I'm like, you know, please watch my next fight, and you'll see it a different way now that you've met me. And I feel like one person by one person, I know that I've made people become fans of the sport. I've always felt like that was part of my duty, because the sport has given me so much.
Yeah. I mean, like, when I see you in a hotel lobby, if your hair's a little longer, right, and it's like combed and you have glasses and like most of the tattoos are covered up, not that that like really matters, but like outwardly it does to the people that you're talking about, right? And then you're very mild mannered, friendly, down to earth person. And then you watch like what you do in there, and it's just like, holy smokes, it's the same guy. It's the same guy. That was the whole thing for me. I always covered traditional sports, and then I got into the UFC, and I was like, the first night I met Paul Felder, we went to dinner. And we both had two-year-olds, and we were talking about the Elmo YouTube video that we watched when they brushed their teeth.
Yeah.
And like, I just thought, I was just like, whoa, they are real people, you know, like they do all of the same things. It's just, you know, they just are very athletic, and they have a mental fortitude to get in there and do what most people would never dream of doing.
Yeah. And for me, it's also about therapy, you know, like, I have used this sport as therapy because everyone's different. And I've coached a lot of guys over the years because I've been a coach almost my whole career.
Yeah.
I think I've been coaching about 15 years. It's helped me grow as an athlete as well. But realizing that everyone's different in the way they mentally prepare for it. But for me, it has always been, you know, the killer cub has been like a separation, and I'm somebody that bottles things in. I don't, you know, talk a lot about stuff, and, you know, things happen because I'm used to a lot being thrown on my plate and a lot of bad stuff happening around me and just going, okay. And so just being used to bottling things up is not, it's not the best. And that's probably why I kind of went off the rails at some point in my early life. And this sport has allowed me to go, okay, be normal, be cub, you know, just, you know, live life, cruise through life. And when those things are you know, when you're that punching bag to life, you get the opportunity to take it out on somebody in a controlled environment and get paid for it and actually entertain people and inspire people. And so, you know, that's when the killer comes out, and I get to do that every so often. And it's become, you know, less and less that I need to do it. And that's been cool about my career is I, you know, as I've gotten paid a little bit more, I don't have to fight as often, and I don't feel like I need to fight as often because, you know, I have a good life. I don't have as many things that I stress about, but I still have those things. And like I said, the harder I fight in the octagon, and the more I give out of that killer, then I'm just cub back home. And that's just worked for me for a long time.
There you have Cub Swanson on the audio podcast version of Fitz Nation. We went about 20 or so more minutes. It's one of those, like, we just kept chatting and he just kept warming up and we just kept talking about different topics. And, you know, if you know Cub, like, he's made this comment in the past where he's done a half hour interview and then he gets asked about Conor McGregor. And then sure enough, the clickbait headline is, Cub thinks Conor this, whatever, right? Even though they had a good conversation, I said, I'm not going to clickbait you, Cub, because that's not what my show is all about. And I think he appreciated, you know, kind of going through the journey, as most of the fighters do. Like, they say that they don't reflect. And I believe it because I don't really reflect on my journey. But I would if somebody asked me about it and I talked about it for an hour. And I really try to get them to go into their memory banks and remember the emotions that they felt, remember all that they've accomplished. And I think it makes them feel good at the end of it for the highs, the lows, everything that makes life what it is for all of us and for fighters, what journeys they have. And Cub Swanson is no stranger to it, what fights he's been in. He is as decorated a competitor as you can find in the MMA world that's never fought for a championship at any level. Isn't that baffling? So anyways, we talk about kind of him getting into the management side of things, him learning the business of MMA and how he plans to spin it forward, and also some good stories related to the UFC 279 press conference. We spoke on Friday. We actually spoke like when the weigh-in fiasco was happening, when Khamzat was weighing in way heavy, and we were kind of clueless to that, but the press conference the day before had been canceled. He had some thoughts on what makes a true fighter, and it's not necessarily puffing your chest out and making a scene. It's about taking care of your business the way that two fighters should when it's time to, like, really throw down and settle things inside the octagon. So anyways, I hope you enjoyed that. Fitz Nation, as always, available on UFC Fight Pass. Follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at BrennanFitzTV. And I will talk to you next time. Again, check out that YouTube channel. And I'll talk to you next time on Fitz Nation. See ya.